From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, dramatic success reported in the effort to lower Milwaukee's teen pregnancy rate. Then Zambian pharmacists train in Wisconsin to ensure HIV patients get the medicine they need.
As a pharmacist, I know how the HIV comes about and the treatment regimens that the patient is supposed to receive and the counseling, which in the past has not been so much emphasized.
We'll look back at the surprising charms of a Marinette department store.
One of the things people like to talk about when they talk about Lorman's is the elevator there, because in Marinette, Lorman's was the first store to have an elevator, or the first building to have an elevator.
And Old World Wisconsin gets ready for a weekend filled with spooky folklore. Lake Effect's next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. We're happy to have you listening today. Milwaukee leaders announced major progress in the community's efforts to reduce teen pregnancy. The city announced 5 years ago it was seeking to reduce the teen pregnancy rate by 46% by 2015. The latest data shows the effort has already exceeded its goal. The overall rate has dropped to just over 25 births per 1,000 girls ages 15 to 17, and in that time, all the major demographic groups saw dramatic declines. Tom Barrett is the mayor of Milwaukee, and he's with us on the line now. Welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be on Lake Effect.
What do you think is the key storyline behind these numbers that came out?
Well, I think the key storyline is really twofold. One is, if you set a goal and if you have community-wide buy-in, the chances of reaching that goal are much greater. Second is, if you get the young people, who are the ones most affected by this, engaged in it, you're likelihood of success skyrockets also. And I think in this situation, back in 2005 and 2006, when United Way led the assessment of teen pregnancy in Milwaukee, and then fast-forwarding to 2008 when we set the goal to reduce the teen pregnancy rate by 46% by 2015, we knew that we were going to have an unprecedented all-hands-on-deck effort. But we also knew that this was a macro problem that really required a micro solution, and that micro solution was reaching young women and men and telling them and having them believe that, yes, it's great to be a parent, but not be a parent between the ages of 15 and 17.
So it's not just the fact that this community-wide approach was taken, but it was the specific community-wide approach that was taken.
Yes, and again, you can have a community-wide approach that is centered on sitting in a boardroom and talking about the problem, or you can have people who are in the trenches who on a daily basis are working with these young people. And I think and I hope we're changing the cultural conversation about birth and when is the appropriate time to become a parent. So obviously we're ecstatic that we have not only met our 2015 goal, but we have exceeded it, and we've exceeded it 3 years early. That's really good news, but it also demonstrates why we cannot take our foot off the accelerator for 1 second. Because the kids, and I say kids, but the young men and women that we've reached now, they're going to be past this age group momentarily, but there's right behind them a new group of kids who are now between 10 and 14 that we have to reach them too. And in a strange way, it's almost like a new generation 5 years later, because what they do is different from what their older peers do.
Well, and the city in the decades before this campaign had among the highest teen birth rates in the country. Is there additional work that needs to be done so that it doesn't always take an all hands on deck approach to maintain these numbers?
Well, obviously, we don't feel like our work is done. We are going to redouble our efforts, and that was one of the questions that came up this morning. Are we going to set new numbers? And of course, we're going to look at that, and we're going to see what we can do to drive these numbers even lower. But we do want to pause, and I just say pause because it's a pause to reflect on the success we've had, but to let the community know, and in particular the young people in this community know, that we're not done with this, that this continues to be an issue that is at the forefront of the city health department's agenda.
Beyond the raw numbers, the impressive raw numbers, is the drop showing benefits in other ways yet? I mean, are you able to say that because the teen pregnancy rate has dropped by 50%, it has another broader effect?
I believe, and I'm not the scientist here, I believe that it has an impact on the infant mortality rate. Now, again, I haven't seen that correlation, but just instinctively or intuitively, I think that. I think what we will see is 4 or 5 years from now, as kids come into school, I think we're going to see some of the fruits of our labor there as well. Because we do know, unfortunately and tragically, that children of teen mothers are more likely to die in infancy. We know that children of teen mothers are more likely to experience child abuse or neglect. We know that children of teen mothers score lower academically. And we also know that they're more likely to become teen parents themselves. So, again, some of the fruits of our labor will not even appear for another 15 to 20 years if these children of teen mothers now, that age group gets pushed further out. So I think there are a lot of additional benefits to this.
Do you think, is this success likely to inform the next full court press, whether it's a public health issue or some other issue?
Well, it already has. And we started out with the whole issue of teen pregnancy. We have now moved to infant mortality. So that's why you've seen the city and the community partners talking and working a lot more on the issue of infant mortality, because they are related. And the United Way has been very, very helpful here, and Mary Lou Young, the CEO over there, has been great. But it's also been the community-based organizations that have been working so hard to address the issue of teen pregnancy and infant mortality. And it's the people in the trenches, our public, our private partners, the Center for Urban Population Health, a lot of people at our health department. But in a probably the most pragmatic way, it's if we can reach the parents, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, and especially the teenagers, then we're going to make this goal a reality.
Mayor Barrett, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very, very much.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett talking about the dramatic decrease in the teen pregnancy rate in the city. You can find a graph showing the progress at WUWM.com/lake effect. A Milwaukee program has been operating under the radar for 27 years to assist healthcare workers in the developing world. We'll learn about it when we return on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. 27 years ago, a group of hospitals, higher education institutions, and companies joined together with Milwaukee County to establish a healthcare partnership with global aspirations. The Center for International Health was started with the assistance of USAID, the Agency for International Development, and after more than a quarter century, it has trained several thousand health workers in more than 40 countries. We'll meet several of those people later in the show, but first, Terry Cooley is the interim president and CEO of the center. Randall Lambrecht is chair of the center's board of directors, in addition to being vice president of research and academic relations at Aurora Healthcare. They're with us now to explain more. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Why is this center, the Center for International Health, here in Milwaukee, and why does it involve the partners that it does?
And that's really the uniqueness of the center. I mean, I think a lot of folks in maybe southeastern Wisconsin don't know that the Milwaukee Center for International Health exists. But it's a very unique consortium, a jewel, if you will, of academic institutions, health systems, and government coming together to look at how we might work on an international level around global health problems.
Well, and these various institutions have a fair amount of responsibility to people in just this region alone. And so expanding it beyond that to serving the world, does that come out of a sense of altruism?
What the center brings to the table in the same respect is the opportunity for them to use those areas of expertise in particular places throughout the world that'll have a maximum impact. One thing we've done is use a model of train the trainers. So when we train 5 people in a country in a particular healthcare area, they might go back and train 10 others. So we have an exponential effect of the training that we've done over the last 25 years.
Let's go back a step and talk about the specific areas. I mean, not all of them, because clearly there are a lot of them. But what are the kinds of areas of expertise that are being tapped? And what is the kind of work that emerges?
Well, one of our early two. I'll start with an earlier one, which was primary health care training, which was done in around 1988 in Malawi and Zimbabwe, where we And our consortium members conducted two-week workshops in each of those countries in primary health care. So that was one of our earlier efforts. A couple years later, we had a very major emergency medical services training program in Poland. And this was just after the collapse of communism, and they were trying to get their economy and their whole, you know, social system, you know, put back together. And one key area that they needed a lot of help in was emergency medicine. We had doctors from the Medical College of Wisconsin and Children's Hospital go over there and provide training in emergency medical services. We held a Polish-American Congress on EMS training in Warsaw in 1995 with people from other countries, from Belarus to Estonia to Latvia, also attending the Congress. So those are some of our earlier efforts.
How does Poland or how does Malawi or how does any of these countries that is leveraging the work of the center, how do they find you? Why do they find you and how does the partnership get going?
Some are found through grants. And certainly in the case of Poland, because we were still rooted in Milwaukee County government, Milwaukee County around that time had also established a sister city relationship with the city of Białystok in Poland. And so that was kind of a springboard for the Center for International Health to kind of move in that direction and provide services in that area.
The center has had a unique relationship, as Terry mentioned before, with some of the governmental agencies, the U.S. Agency for International Development for one, and the American International Health Alliance. These are agencies who initially worked with the center, were really impressed by the work of the center, and then we continue to forge those relationships. So a lot of the work comes through the center rather than having to work with multiple institutions because the attractiveness of the consortium that can bring a lot of resources together.
I wonder about analogies to other programs like say, the Peace Corps. How much of what the center does is about jump-starting work that's being done and how much is about instilling programs that can be self-sustaining in these countries?
I think we're always looking for self-sustaining, you know, approaches to the opportunities we've gone into. Sometimes that's possible. Sometimes it may not be. But I would say that's always the effort that we try to look toward. As an example, Milwaukee County has a relationship in Buffalo City, which is in South Africa. And we received a Sister Cities grant that the center had helped the county apply for, and then the center really managed the project. And that has provided an expansion of a women's health clinic in that area, an improvement of the water supply, additional rooms to see women in, and it's increased the number of women who can be seen in the clinic by 30-some percent. That's there for now and in the future. So that's an idea of a sustainable project.
There recently was a new agreement that the center entered into with a couple of institutions for the administration of the work that's being done. Why was that an important step in the evolution of the Center for International Health?
We're really excited about the new agreement. For many years, Children's Hospital served as the fiscal agent, administrative agent for the center, and they've been a terrific partner. I think after 25 years, we're now in our 27th year, I think, of existence. We've thought that it really needs to broaden out and other consortium members wanted to step up and support the center. So what makes UWM so attractive is the breadth and depth of a university that a university brings to a center like ours. I mean, they have the Institute of World Affairs and they have schools and colleges and public health and nursing and health sciences, plus the liberal arts, which I think give the center that sort of awareness and breadth and depth. The other part of that is the Medical College of Wisconsin, which has long had a really rigorous global health program. And I think it's called Nations to Neighborhoods. But it articulates and work and sits very well with the mission of the center. How do we take care of health issues outside of the country, but that can maybe be translated to urban centers or even rural areas?
Well, and that gets to another question I had, which is there something that American health practitioners and organizations and institutions take from doing this work in places where quality health care isn't necessarily something people can take for granted?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's a great educational environment for students as well as faculty and practitioners. And I think whether it's a food relief program or whether we're trying to tackle issues around HIV and AIDS in countries that have very little healthcare. What we can bring to the table in terms of training the trainer and leaving there with something better than they had is really the goal of our efforts overseas.
Well, and is there a vision for where this could be going?
Well, there's no shortage of health needs, and the thing about healthcare is that it knows no boundaries. So it's really important to all of our institutions, and even in the U.S., that we understand and can help with problems that occur overseas. So I think as we look at the next decade or maybe 20 years of the center, we really want to get in those communities where we can make a difference and then bring that knowledge back and address issues that impact our own communities here. I think that's sort of the goal of the academic institutions and the healthcare systems that are part of our center.
And I would add that while the center had its roots with local government, and local government is still providing support, for about 15 years, we've been a 501c3 nonprofit, so we've got the flexibility that brings to bring in and out different consortium members or others outside of our consortium, depending on the program that we're focusing on.
Well, it's a terrific story. Thank you to both of you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for letting us tell it.
Thank you.
Terry Cooley is interim president and CEO of the Milwaukee-based Center for International Health. Randall Lambrecht is chair of the center's board of directors. One of the center's current programs involves training pharmacists from Zambia in work to treat pediatric HIV and AIDS. We'll meet some of the people involved in that work when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we heard the story of the Center for International Health, a consortium of institutions around Milwaukee helping train medical workers in the developing world. One project the center is undertaking is to train pharmacists in Zambia to better reach pediatric HIV and AIDS patients. Four pharmacists are in southeast Wisconsin training at Concordia University's School of Pharmacy. We're joined by them, Elvis Kasongo, Enoch Chikatula, Walya Simanyola, and Davies Kampamba, along with Dean Arneson, who's dean of the school, and the center's president and CEO, Terry Cooley, is with us again as well. Arneson explains why, though there are effective drugs to treat HIV, it remains a challenge to provide treatment in places like Zambia.
Part of it has been the expense of the medication, and because it's new and there's been a lot of research that has to be done, it makes it very expensive for the medications to be produced and available to the patients.
Are there issues with capacity in Zambia? Is it difficult, even if the medicines are there, to transport it and physically get it in the hands of the people that need it?
I think for Zambia, that's why we came up with this partnership. One of the challenges, which was identified, the capacity, and we looked at the pharmacist's role in being part of the team, providing the care to pediatrics HIV patients. So we looked at the challenges which were there. That's how we came up with this partnership, so that we could be able to meet some of those challenges.
Well, and talk more about the specific challenges that you face. For example, when we talk about medicine in this country, there are drugstores, there are pharmacies in almost every neighborhood, and as well as in hospitals and clinics. How are medicines typically distributed, especially very specialized medicines like these antiretrovirals? How are they distributed in Zambia?
Okay, we've got a central supply system where the government procures centrally. And then we've got a central stores, which is mandated to distribute all the drugs to all areas of the country in all health facilities. But if you look at the system, it means it's serving a wide area. So you have challenges in terms of transportation. And sometimes if the logistics are not properly done, you find that some drugs may run out prior to the thing that's, the target that was set. That aside, the other challenge that I would like mention here is what I've also seen here, the issue of stigma. In as much as people know that antiretroviral drugs are there, but because they are stigmatized, they don't really come forth.
Well, and so how does Concordia set up a program to assist with something as big as stigma?
In working with our students and in their training in the pharmacy program, we teach the students that it's why the person has the disease, it's not their fault. You're treating them as a patient. You're treating them as a person, and you don't worry about the stigma of why they got the disease, how they got it, but you're there to help them get better. And so that's what we use to – how we train our students to understand that.
And this is not something that people necessarily think of when they become a pharmacist, the idea that you're not just working with medicines, but you're working almost as a counselor in ways?
So one of the things, actually, if you look at like this partnership that we have had, especially with Concordia, in the past, we know, of course, that pharmacy per se has had this traditional role, which has been product-centered. So my main interest would just be the drug and the drug and not – the end user. If you look at the paradigm shift that we have seen in the pharmacy profession, we are no longer so much interested in the product. The product is still very important, but I think we have in the past and for a long time neglected the patient. Yeah. So hence this partnership that we developed with Concordia so that pharmacists can be actually introduced in the clinical areas and get the required knowledge and the skills in dealing with patients now, seeing our colleagues here well advanced than us. And then the knowledge that we get back, we take it back home and try to put it into practice. Yep.
And we have talked about some of the guiding principles for the Center for International Health itself. Is one of the aims of this program to get to the point where this sort of training can be taking place in schools and universities and teaching hospitals in Zambia itself?
This is a program that the Center for International Health has been involved in since 2006, and we've established additional learning resource centers in two different hospitals in Zambia. We have been following what the center has used in many other instances, which is a train-the-trainer program. So yes, the idea is to train individuals, including the four pharmacists we have here today, so that they can go back and provide additional training to other people at hospital and university settings in Zambia.
And I think that's one of the goals with this eventually is, you know, like as Terry said, training the trainers, have these four pharmacists advance their skills and get to a level where we can work with the Ministry of Education in Zambia and hopefully start providing the Doctor of Pharmacy degree in Zambia.
Do you see the paradigm shifting in Zambia already? I mean, you mentioned the shift from thinking of this as a drug-specific, a product-specific profession to one that's more about the patients and the people. Is the stigma getting any less? Do you see the efforts already making a difference in terms of people with HIV?
Well, yes, it is. One thing that we may have not mentioned is everyone of us here, the four of us from Zambia, are coming from teaching hospitals. So in those teaching hospitals, you have like newly qualified pharmacists, doctors, nurses, and students. And with the knowledge that we've gotten in the past, which like ushers us into clinical areas, and especially with this training that we are having here, when we go back, you find that this knowledge will not just be restricted to the University Teaching Hospital, Livingstone General Hospital, and as Dean and Terry have talked about, mentors. Pharmacists and students who pass through these institutions will definitely be exposed to this knowledge and the skills, so that even when they finish their rotations in these hospitals, they will be posted to different hospitals in the country. And with that, I mean, patients will definitely benefit from that because as a pharmacist, I know how the HIV comes about and the treatment regimens that the patient is supposed to receive and the counseling, which in the past has not been so much emphasized. So the patient will definitely get the counseling and the patient education is definitely emphasized. So with that, the knowledge that a pharmacist would have, we would definitely spend more time on counseling, and patients definitely will get their education on that.
Well, and in addition to counseling, I gather there is also an issue of teaching the patients how to take their medicine and to stay on the prescribed regimen, correct?
Yeah.
Well, that's what we call adherence. The importance of adherence, of course, it will come in the counseling session. You tell the patients why it's important to adhere to treatment. One of the first things that you talk about is resistance. And that is a big challenge in that what we've seen here is that you've got much more leverage in that you've got so many drugs that you could, like, go to. But back home, that is a limitation. So we cannot afford to have patients be resistant to the current regimens that we have. And one other thing that we're so happy about is that we're being exposed to resistance sequences and trained. So if we have to, like, change a regimen, we'll look at the resistance pattern and so forth and so on. So really, it's been a mouthful.
Yeah, and something just related to that patient counseling issues of adherence, We've been privileged with this partnership that we have had with the Center for International Health and American International Health Alliance in supporting the services, pharmacy services that is back home. They've helped us set up two learning resource centers at the two institutions. In those learning resource centers, we've had a drug information database, that is a Lexicomp. So in that component, we have a patient education portion in there. And therefore, that information is like at the level of a patient where a patient would easily understand the medication that they are taking and things like that. So with the advancement, definitely, we see patient leaflets being given to patients and therefore give them the knowledge to their understanding. Yeah.
One of the things that has come out of this has been reaching out to other educational organizations in the area. I've had them meet with a professor at UW-Milwaukee School of Nursing who's doing a research project on HIV meds and adherence in American pharmacies, Dr. Jennifer Kabiko. And so they're helping her with some of the research that she's doing there. She's from Kenya. And so there may be something that they can take back to Zambia and partner with her and do some part of the study in Zambia looking at adherence and what pharmacists are doing to increase adherence there and compare that what American pharmacists are doing it here.
Do the four of you feel an added responsibility as having been able to take advantage of this program here, this notion that you are going to go back and be in a position to train the other people that that you work with?
What we have gained is a lot of information. We've seen how the distribution is done, and there's so much that we can actually take back to our country. Like, for example, where I'm working right now at ARCW, there's a lot of patient follow-up where they do actually phone patients. That doesn't happen in our country. So it's something that I'm hoping, you know, I would take back to management to say, somehow we try and see if we can find some monies to have these phones in case a patient doesn't come for 3-4 days. We try to see and find out what the problem could be and if there's a way that we could actually bring them without them going to the extent of having resistance to the medication, which in the long run would be a cost-saving measure.
I think one of the challenge for us is to come up with the action plans or activity-based plans so that we take back home and see how best we can implement some of the things we are learning here.
This is a remarkable opportunity.
Yeah. Whatever we take from here, we try to do it within our resources in a small way. We cannot do everything that's done here, because most of the things Americans are innovators and we learn from them. So we can give an example of when we just started. We were attached to Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, and they have a system where they do unit dosing. And then we have a challenge back home where we don't have a range of doses, like for children where I have maybe solid dosage forms, and an ideal dosage form for children is a syrup-based dosage form. So we copied that concept and started doing unit dosing for the patients. So everything that we learned from here, of course it's a challenge, but I think we're energized to start up whatever program that it is, because we're seeing a lot of gaps and we're trying to see how we can bridge those gaps, and we really thank the partnership for that.
And you're here until when?
Mid of December.
Yeah. Are you prepared for December in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is not the best time we've been
snow.
Here.
They keep asking me when the snow is going to fly. So,
we've been here.
Just wait.
Well, hopefully the snow won't fall too soon, but that you get to experience some more of it before too long. Well, thank you to all of you, and best of luck with your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you.
Elvis Kasongo, Enoch Chikatula, Walya Simanyola, and Davies Kampamba are pharmacists in the African nation of Zambia. They're training this fall at Concordia University's School of Pharmacy. Dean Arneson is Dean of the Pharmacy School, and Terry Cooley is Interim President and CEO of the Center for International Health, of which the pharmacy training is a current project. You'll find a link to more about the center's work at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And there's more of Lake Effect coming your way in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's not even Halloween yet, and department stores are already putting up their Christmas decorations. Makes the case that department stores are, or at least were in the past, places you could go to get anything, including very early Christmas decorations. We all probably remember the big department store names from our past: Gimbel's, Schuster's, Marshall Field's, and if you're from Marinette, Lorman's. Author Michael Liana memorializes the store of the past in his new book, Something for Everyone. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce about why the store held such personal appeal for him.
It was a wonderful place, and it was much like other department stores that used to exist all over. So I think telling the story was a good idea. I think it needed to be preserved. My father worked there for close to 50 years, and he was a department manager for many of those years. I wanted to honor him. This came up. It was an idea I had, and I went to some of the Lorman family members and asked them about it, and I said, if you don't want me to do it, I won't. But they all the ones I talked to said, go for it and do it. So, and they seem to be happy with it today. And doing this, I found out that it was very important to lots of people up there. As I interviewed more and more people, it was a really good topic. People enjoyed talking about it and remembering it.
What conditions made it right for the Lorman brothers to get together and open this store in Marinette?
When Marinette was a kind of a boom town, it was a lumber town back around 1890 when the store opened. And the Lorman brothers, there were three brothers who came to Marinette from southern Wisconsin. They found this place that had a lot of potential, and they opened a small store and took it from there. The store expanded a couple of times, and then they built this big store that still exists right in the center of Marinette. And that's the store that most people think of when they think of Lorman's.
Now, there's a great story at the beginning of the book where the store almost didn't come to pass thanks to a chance encounter on a trip through Chicago.
Oh, yeah. It's a famous story in the family. I heard from different family members of the Lormans. Joseph Lorman was the oldest brother, and he took their savings and traveled to New York, actually, to buy merchandise when the store first opened. And he had the money hidden in his belt, I think. And he told the story later on that somebody he met in Chicago in between trains talked him into, or wanted to talk him into, going into a tavern and possibly throw some dice or something like that. And he said, if I hadn't resisted that, if I hadn't gotten out of there, I may have not had that money. They started the whole business with $1,100 that they saved up over a few years, and these two young brothers started the store. Then they recruited their younger brother, the youngest in the family, came up and helped them then. So there were three, but essentially two in the beginning, and apparently that may have happened to him in Chicago, and they think that the store might not have got its start if he hadn't resisted that offer from that man.
That temptation.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about these brothers? What was their vision for this store? What did they want it to be? There were a lot of other stores in Marinette at that time.
The funny thing is the whole history of the department store is an interesting one, I think, that things were being done differently across the country and even over. The department store really began in Europe. But they started putting things together in stores rather than putting them in strictly clothes or strictly shoes. And the department store kind of came to be. Some people accepted it and some people didn't or embraced it. The Lormans had this idea and they succeeded at it. They put the right kinds of merchandise in there. A lot of the success is attributed to the fact that the people in Marinette appreciated their selection. They would have very good top-of-the-line merchandise, but they also would have items that were not of top quality but were more affordable. So they had a wide variety of things that appealed to a wide variety of people. So,
hence the title, Something for Everyone.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But you also identified other factors that attributed to its success. Can you talk about those?
Well, sure. They offered really good service. At one time, the department stores offered all sorts of little things, parades and fashion shows and little classes on how to use the bicycles in the bicycle department, how to use this new wax that they've sold for the floors. You know, they would offer all sorts of little things, free gift wrap and free delivery. When I talk to people today about Lorman's or any old department store, people really respond because enough time has passed now and people kind of yearn for those days, I'm finding, when you could call and get good service, when you could buy something with the confidence that you'd You didn't have to, you know, worry that it wasn't going to be backed up. And here's just a little piece from the book. This is Jerry Blum, and he was the manager there eventually in the appliance department. And he said, on Monday mornings, we'd go out and oil up all the ringers and motors on customers' washing machines. I remember going to your grandma's. We'd oil up the machine, and she'd give us coffee and bakery. Before you knew it, we were outside hanging the clothes on the line. And it goes on from there. Yeah, it's amazing that people really did that. It sounds like when you talk to somebody younger today about this, it sounds like you're talking about a different planet almost, that where this kind of thing happened. Every one of these department stores across the country was unique, but each one kind of followed a parallel path. This is why when I wrote this book, I kind of kept that in mind, and I've been hearing from people who said they read it, they'd never even have been in Marinette, but they remember their hometown department store, and everything that's written in here reminds them of what they experienced too.
Yet each store did have something unique, and Lorman's had a few unique features that really made going to the store an experience.
Yes. It just struck me after interviewing people that there were certain things that everybody wanted to talk about, so I started to make a note of that. The number one item for Lorman's, and most people guess it right away, the malt ice cream cone was something unique to Lorman's and Marinette. And everybody wants to know, how can I get one of those again? And I did a lot of research and talked to various people. And the conclusion in the end is, you won't ever get one again because the recipe is gone. The machines no longer are there. And perhaps I'll be proven wrong by somebody sometime. It was a very memorable part of going to Lorman's store. Some of the other things that were unique to Lorman's were not food related. One of the things people like to talk about when they talk about Lorman's is the elevator there, because in Marinette, Lorman's was the first store to have an elevator, or the first building to have an elevator, and people were just thrilled by it. They were frightened of it. They wouldn't go on it. They wouldn't let their children near it. Other people loved going on it. They thought it was such a thrill, and it was just a slow-moving little elevator that went up from the basement to the third floor.
What about the employee experience? What were some of the more interesting stories that you collected as you talked to people who had worked there?
There's an appendix at the end of the book with a list of names of people who worked there for 30 or more years, and the list is pretty long. You know, there were people there who came to ask about a job, and they ended up staying for half of a century. You know, it's amazing. There's a lot of them. And they today, by and large, they're very proud of their experience there, and they love talking about Lorman's store. People fondly remember it. They kind of yearn for those old days again. So I would get that feeling every time I talk with one of these people.
Was there a story that really stuck out to you?
Oh, there were several. Let's think. There was one woman who gave me the story that she went to apply for a job there, and she was told, well, we'll keep your name here and we'll keep in touch with you if something opens up. When she turned and left, she found on the stairway as she was leaving the store, she found a wallet on the floor and opened it up, and there were $60 in it. She returned it to that same man at the desk where she applied for the job and gave it to him. The next day, she was offered a job, saying, you were so honest, we want to give you the job. And she stayed there for 39 years. She also got a gift from the woman in Michigan who the wallet belonged to, some kind of a hand-embroidered set of pillowcases or something like that. You know, it's just, you know, there are a lot of stories like this.
So how does the story of Lorman's end?
Well, it's no fun to read that last chapter, but it's necessary to write that and to read that. The department store decline kind of started in the 20s, though. Without the Depression and without World War II, perhaps it would have gone under sooner. But those factors helped to make it a going concern for a greater number of years. In the 50s, there were some indications. In the 60s, for sure. That's when stores like Target and Kmart came along. And the 70s, the Lorman store was still going fine. Some of their satellite stores that they opened around 1930, they one by one went under. They had stores in Iowa and in Michigan and elsewhere in Wisconsin. In the end, in the 70s, the big store in Marinette was the only one left, and it finally closed in 1987. And that's probably about – that's about the same era when Prangies and Gimbel's and a lot of these stores went under. In the 80s, the store started – the business started to decline. And at one time, Lorman's little Marinette had a store that employed 440 people around 1935, somewhere in there. And in the very end, there were 28 people employed full-time. They consolidated different departments. They had whole sections of the store that were empty. And luckily, it still exists and stands in downtown Marinette. Many of these old department stores are gone. But there was not much anybody could do. This was happening all across the country. And it was just hard, you know, because this was a beloved place. And it was time to admit that we have to close.
Well, Micah Leanna, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about Lorman's.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Micah Leanna's book is called Something for Everyone, Memories of Lorman Brothers Department Store. A writer, radio playwright, and former public school employee, Leanna lives in Sheboygan. He spoke with Stephanie Lachey. One last break, and then Old World Wisconsin gets ready for a spooky weekend. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke. When Old World Wisconsin was trying to figure out what to do for its first Halloween-themed family event, the staff knew it didn't want to build just another haunted house. Instead, the idea was to create an event that also spoke to what the Living History Museum is all about, celebrating the immigrant experience in Wisconsin. So Old World's Halloween Legends and Lore experience features the folktales and spooky stories immigrants brought with them to the Badger State. Assistant Director Bob Parker tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce, while we frighten each other with ghost stories today, the immigrants had a different reason for telling these tales.
It was a way to reconnect. These were stories that they had heard themselves as children. And so by retelling them and gathering together to retell these stories, they were able to connect themselves with their past. They were able to connect with other immigrant families who had similar backgrounds and could, you know, had these similar kind of stories in their repertoire. So there was a familiarity and comfort that came from telling these stories. It kind of placed them together. It reminded them of who they were or where they had come from, while they were still kind of negotiating all of the strangeness of being in a completely new land and a new experience. Also, it was a way of perhaps shielding themselves. You know, there's a lot of places where they really believe that the stories and the costumes that come with Halloween were donned to protect themselves from the spirits of the night and the spirits of the dead. You know, cold Celtic legends say that, you know, people would put on these horrific costumes in order to make sure that the actual spirits of the dead thought that they were one of them and so they wouldn't get bothered by them. You know, it was kind of a protective thing in many respects.
Is there a similarity that you see? I mean, can you trace some of the Wisconsin-based legends that you've researched from those legends and lore of the immigrants from their home countries?
Well, I think you can probably find similarities. The folk tales and the folklore that we are telling for our event this year that are coming from Europe, we're really kind of focusing more on the fairy tales and the folklore. You know, we're telling the legends of the banshee. We have, there's a wonderful story about Baba Yaga, the Eastern European or Russian witch or hag or nature goddess that they talk about in that area. We're talking about Jack-O-Lantern, whose name in some folklore is Jack-O-Kenton, until he tricks the devil. And because he tricks the devil and he gets a special dispensation from the devil, he tricks the devil, and the devil agrees that he will not take Jack into hell. And so Jack feels like, well, okay, he's got it made. He can do whatever he wants to, and he doesn't have to worry about going into hell. But then he dies, and St. Peter won't take him into heaven either. So now he can't get into heaven, and he can't get into hell. And so he's cursed to wander the earth as a spirit with only a coal and a pumpkin head to light his way. And so that kind of is the, you know, origin of Jack-O-Lantern. So, we tell those stories. We tell some Grimm's fairy tales, kind of, you know, the original versions, the non-comforting versions so much.
Now, Bob, did you come across any interesting tidbits while you were researching these stories?
I did. I found we found many different stories, and we found many different Halloween poems and all sorts of games and activities that they used to recommend in the 19th century. We found all sorts of fun things. One of my favorite is a poem that I found, and if you don't mind, I'd like to. It's pretty short, and I'd just like to read that for you, so you can kind of get a sense as to some of the fun that they had. This story or this poem is called "Ghosts in the Barn," and it goes like this. The barn's haunted loft is gloomy and still. The spider webs cover the mold. Where sun arrows shoot through holes in the roof and rafters are lined with gold. Hist! Hearken to goblins' footsteps or wings. I hear them so plain, don't you? The ghosts us children find in the barn, they flit around and cry, ooh, ooh. No, sir, it is not the rats in the mow nor noise of the wind that moans. They're ghosts that haunting the old barn loft with awful screeches and groans. We hide and we watch, all holding our breath. We hear and we see them too. By day or by night, when the wind's blowing right, they dodge round and cry, woo, woo. At night they bewitch the horses' long manes. They tangle the harnesses all. They tie the halters in goblins' knots. They let loose the horse in a stall. They swing in the rafters, spiderweb swings. They dance and they drink the dew. They revel all night, and when it is light, they flit round and cry, woo, woo. And I like that poem because it's such a rural kind of poem with ghosts in the barn. And of course, you know, we're talking about 19th century Wisconsin. Old World is a museum of the rural experience, and so it fits in beautifully.
I don't want to steal the thunder of any of the performers that will be out at Old World this weekend, but can you maybe give us a sampling, maybe tell us a Wisconsin story that won't necessarily be part of this program, but give us a good old Wisconsin ghost story?
You know, one of the most famous of the Wisconsin stories is the story about the Ridgeway ghost. And a lot of people have heard about him. He kind of roamed the area of southwestern Wisconsin, kind of around the Mineral Point, Dodgeville area, back in the 19th century, and kind of had a reputation as a trickster ghost. He would start people's well pumps running when there was nobody about. They would look out the window and see their well handle, their pump handle going up and down and up and down, and water pouring out, and there would be nobody around. Or he might abscond with a farmer's piece of equipment or chase away horses or something like that. And he often would take the shape, oddly enough, of animals as well. So he was a very multi-talented, multi-faceted ghost who could kind of do all sorts of things and kind of help explain all sorts of things that were happening around there. There's a story that goes around that is about, like you said, kind of talks more about his trickster nature. They're coming along a road, and there's a gentleman up ahead of us, and he turns and he says, "Well, hello there. Evening, folks. You're not planning on heading down the road, are you? Why, I wouldn't if I were you. The Ridgeway ghost is active tonight, and you're liable to find yourself in the same situation as I'm in, or worse. But take a look at my wagon. You notice anything missing? That ghost is a prankster, all right. A couple of hours ago, I was heading to the fort for a load of supplies when I came up against a flock of sheep just standing in the road. And no matter what I did, they wouldn't move. I raged at them. I tried to part them with the horse. Nothing. They would not move. So finally, I saw a man come out of the trees ahead of the sheep, and he stood in the road staring at me. He seemed to be enjoying my predicament, and no matter how I called to him to move his sheep, he just stood and stared at me. Well, there's only so much a man can take, and I jumped off my wagon and forced my way through the sheep towards him. By God, if he wouldn't move his sheep, then I would move him. But it was tough going, for the sheep didn't part as I approached any more than they'd parted in front of my wagon. I had to force my way through them like I was wading through deep snow. The strangest part was that they made no noise. I heard my own footsteps on the gravel and the wind and my grumbling, but I heard nothing from the sheep, not a bleat, not a baa, not even the sound of their own hooves scrabbling on the gravel as I pushed them aside. Well, I suppose if I had been calmer, I'd have paused when I noticed that, but my blood was up, and every step I took closer to that man, who was just standing and staring at me, fired me up higher and higher. Finally, when I was within about 20 yards of him, he jumped up and ran into the woods. I had never seen anything so cowardly, and I just stood and stared back at the spot where he disappeared into the trees in dumb amazement. And then I noticed that I could no longer feel the pressure of the sheep crowding around my legs. I looked down, and the sheep were gone, all of them. They just vanished like they'd never been there at all. But I don't have to tell you, that shook me. I turned around back to my wagon, and there was the man who a few moments before had jumped into the trees. He was slapping the rear of my horse and screaming like a banshee. Well, my horse just bolted and raced away down the road there with that crazy man riding and slapping and laughing away on top of him. I raced after him as fast as I could, just pure seething rage coursing through my veins. Of course, if I'd had my senses around me, I would have known that there was no way I could catch a galloping horse, no matter how fast I run. But my senses had flown clear out of my head. What made it worse was that the horse thief continued to taunt me every time I slowed down to catch my wind. Well, he could easily have pulled away from me. But every time my spirit began to flag, he would pause my horse and point and laugh until the rage boiled up again and I charged back after him. Well, this went on and on until, just as my heart was about to burst and my legs about to pitch me over, I stumbled through a copse of trees, and there was my horse, standing alone in a meadow, trembling, munching the long grass and watching me approach as if wondering why I hadn't found him sooner. I walked up to him, slow and calm, so he wouldn't spook, expecting that my tormentor would suddenly spring up from the tall grass and race my horse away again, but it never happened. I mounted, started back. I was starting to calm down and feel better until I got back to my wagon and found that every one of my wheels was gone. I screamed and I leapt down from my horse and threw my hat on the ground, and at that moment, my tormentor suddenly reappeared, laughing and laughing, and just as my blood was boiling again, he slapped one hand against his thigh, pointed at my horse with the other hand, and my horse immediately bolted away again down the road and disappeared. So now, here I sit, on a wagon with no wheels and no horse, and I'm afraid to search for either in fear I'll return and find the whole cart gone. And how do I know it was the ghost? Because as my horse disappeared down the road, I saw the ghost vanish as well, just fade away without moving. And even after he was completely gone, I could still hear his mocking laugh.
Well, Bob Parker, thank you for giving me the chills.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Bob Parker is assistant director at Old World Wisconsin. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. The Living History Museum in Eagle will host Halloween Legends and Lore on Friday and Saturday. You'll find all you need to know from a link at wuwm.com/lake effect. That's all for today's show. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.
This is Halloween. This is Halloween. Halloween, 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 Halloween. Halloween.